Good afternoon. It's Thursday, the 25th of May, 2017, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. I'm your host, Brian Gerrish, with me in the studio, Mike Robinson. And we're joined today by David Ellis of Strategic Defence Initiatives. And my goodness, what a lot is happening post-Manchester bombings. We're going to have a look at how we see some of the events that are unfolding around us. But what better place to start than with the BBC? And I just had to highlight this, that when we follow through on the BBC news reporting, Coronation Street has now been brought into the Manchester bombing arena. So well done. £4 billion worth of BBC government propaganda machine. So the bombing toned down to the level of Coronation Street. Just amazing, in my opinion.
Yep. Well, of course, G7 in preparation at the moment. And well, Sky News pushing out this, their Sky Views. Should this G7 summit go virtual? So what are they saying? They're saying hardly the... sun, sea, sand and soldiers, lots of them, holding lots of guns. Hardly the image the residents of Sicilian resort of Taormina want in the holiday brochures, but those sort of pictures will be beamed globally in the coming days as world leaders descend for the annual G7 get-together. Just getting the likes of Donald Trump in and out of the town has proved a logistical nightmare. Old, narrow, winding streets don't make for easy cavalcade manoeuvres. And the Americans in particular have big gripes about security. And so it goes on. Theresa May is going to be dropping in, as will Emmanuel Macron and so on. So they are calling for the G7 to go virtual. Sure, change would take away the opportunity for cities and nations to showcase their attractions and their issues, the article says. But they think that that is the best approach for dealing with this issue of security. Brian, how long is it going to be before we never actually see our alleged leaders?
Well, we know, maybe we're not going to see them at all, Mike, or maybe we're going to only see our leaders projected as a hologram. And what it's going to do, of course, is totally distort reality. You will have no idea, watching the box, what you're actually seeing, real or digitally enhanced or fake. No idea at all. It's 1984 in 2017, of course.
Absolutely. Now, the main focus, at least Italy wants this to be the main focus of the G7, is going to be Africa. And obviously migration is going to take part in that. Donald Trump, as we said, is going to be there. Theresa May is going to be there. And they are saying that, you know, common sight off the coast of Italy in recent years, particularly off the coast of Sicily in recent years, has been the boatloads of migrants. They're concerned about that. They want to do something about it and talk to the other leaders about it. I don't see too much mention from the G7 about what caused this problem in the first place. Let's not mention Libya at all. And the fact that as we continue our geopolitical shenanigans in the area with three sort of governments in waiting, none of them really knowing which one is going to end up being the actual government, one of the three of them supported or backed by the United Nations and the other two not. And in the meantime, Libyans have made people trafficking their main source of income. So let's not mention that, though. We're going to find other solutions to this. But it's okay, because apparently they don't just want to talk about crises like migration and famine, but also promote innovation in Africa and see what they can do to help.
Right, that's good.
Good, isn't it? Yep. Well, as I said, Theresa May is going to be there, but she's not sticking it out till the end. She's going to cut short her visit, and apparently she's coming back on Friday. She didn't say what's on screen at the moment, but I'll read it out anyway, because this is what she would have said if she had been
you
asked.
You read
I'm
her
sure.
mind.
I did,
yeah.
Yes. She said, I'm coming back on Friday, threat level high, enabling act in the works, need to be here to consolidate my position. Her position of what is it? Strength and stability? That's her position?
Leader, Mike. The word coming forward is...
Supreme leader?
Führer, I think, is the correct expression. It's Theresa May and her team. We're drifting away from a government now. What we really need is a leader, one leader. And this is coming in very, very strongly, as we're going to be showing in the news.
Okay.
So what is Theresa May coming back to? Well, let's pop back to the BBC, always a good place to go, particularly if we're going to ramp up the hatred and alarm. And here we are, UK officials incandescent with rage at US leaks. And what is all this about? Well, all of a sudden we learn a remarkable fact that Greater Manchester Police, as they do, have been sharing the intelligence about the attacks with US intelligence agencies. And it now appears that the US intelligence agencies have shared the information with the media in America. And oh dear, the media in America has now published pictures. And these have obviously come back to UK. And as the BBC says, that the British government officials are incandescent with rage that such delicate information should have been leaked. But quite remarkable what's being talked about, because, of course, we're being told that this was a very big bomb. We're being told that it was full of nuts and bolts, very dangerous, killed 22 people and 59 people, I think, is the latest on the injured. So this was a significant weapon. We just pop across to the Mail here. And the Mail carried this image, which is of the cleanup operation in the foyer. So we've got paramedics tending people who are prone on the floor. There appears to be a lot of blood around. This is the comment the Mail has in its article, and I encourage people to go and read it. It says a US intelligence official said the bomber used was so big and sophisticated, including materials hard to obtain in Britain, that it was almost impossible to see. He didn't have help. So all of a sudden, Greater Manchester Police simply telling the Americans what they're up to. But here we've got more information. It was a big, sophisticated bomb, including materials hard to obtain in Britain. Other reports are saying actually that it was the same explosive used in Paris. So it's almost like the debate has gone clear of British intelligence services and is now being worked on by the US. Nobody in control. This appears to be a shambles, but we could ask, when did Britain's police start working hand in glove with US intelligence agencies? What I want to just bring in here, and I would like some answers to this, a big sophisticated bomb that killed 22 people. I was very interested that behind these workers is a very long length of strip light. This will be fluorescent tubes without question. No damage. I don't see any damage, and I'm very puzzled. So we recognise a bomb has gone off here, but could somebody please give us some help with why there is no physical damage to the building? Mm. And then we're going to say thank you very much to the Manchester Evening News for this report. Firefighters are infuriated after they were stopped from helping bomb victims at Manchester Arena. Now, this is quite a headline. It's a very, very good article. Please go and read it. But let's just give you a little snapshot. They basically said the nearest crews were based at Manchester Central. That's only half a mile away. They were sent to pre-alerts. Now, what they mean by that is within a few minutes of the bomb going off, they were told to stand by. You're going to be called. That's very understandable. They prepared to go to the scene, but were instead told to rendezvous at Phillips Park Station. They waited there for an hour. They were told to wait for specialists who had, quote, bulletproof overalls to arrive. So these fire crews itching to go, told to wait, told to wait, told to wait. And what happens then? They had to watch what was happening. They said as they waited, knowing that paramedics had already said, where are the fire brigade? They had to sit and simply watch what was happening on the television. Eventually, five appliances had dispatched, but by then, all of the dangerous work of entering the blasted arena foyer to tend to badly hurt and dying victims had been done. And basically, they arrive on scene 90 minutes after the 10:33 attack. So very interesting, Mike. We see a picture. We're told that the foyer area is blasted by the bomb, but the lighting appears to be intact. And then the fire service are deliberately delayed. And they are so angry about what happened that they're calling for an investigation. Perhaps we just bring Dave Ellis in at this point. David, there are so many questions to be asked about what has happened around this. Let's remember that Theresa May was Home Secretary, responsible for making sure that the nation was prepared to deal with a terrorist bomb. And yet around this instance, we have a shambles.
Yes, you're right, Brian. There's a huge amount of questions to be asked. And the principal thing that we've all got to centre on is that whilst being responsible as Home Secretary and now Amber Rudd, they're really ultimately responsible for this situation to be coming around under their ministerships. And they are now seeking re-election. And I am fundamentally convinced that they are not, under this situation, fit to be re-elected. That they are, you know, they're entirely, you know, the indictment upon them, upon the situation here rests on their shoulders. But where the management of this is concerned, what the government is doing in terms of managing the press and what's happening and what's being released, on the one hand, looks like it's being managed in a certain fashion. And then on the other hand, it looks like as if it's being completely sort of slapdash. So it's very, 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 very confusing. So is it deliberately confusing? It's not good. It really isn't good that you've got this sort of, you know, these snippets coming out about, you know, that there's conflict between the security services here in the UK and in America. Not good at all.
David, this is a cynical question, but do you think that the Tories would use this bombing incident in order to help drive their own election campaign, their media campaign for their election efforts?
Well, I mean, let's deal with the facts. They're currently in sort of, you know, they're still effectively ministers of the government, and they're still politicians, and they're seeking to be re-elected. So they kind of hold all the offices and all the cards, if you want to put it that way, politically and as state. So will they use it politically? I would think they would. Yeah. I wouldn't put anything past them. I mean, I've got to come back to a fundamental here. When we broke the story about David Cameron and Number 10, so it's the same group of people, although that, you know, the frontline actors have changed between May and Cameron. The rest of the machinery is still the same. If they were prepared to take officers of high state, like chiefs of defence staff, admirals and generals, and append them in a fabricated letter stating that they supported staying in the EU, this lets everyone know what you are dealing with. These are, you know, high state officers of the state in really, really important positions. And you've got the government and Number 10 prepared to take their names in vain. So let's not underestimate what these people are capable of if they're prepared to do that. And this is a legitimate question, as far as I'm concerned. What else are they prepared to do?
Of course, we should probably mention, of course, that Amber Rudd isn't the Home Secretary anymore.
Indeed, no.
But what it wasn't clear whether her new title of Minister for the Interior was purely an invention of the media, or whether the media is getting this from civil service or some other briefing?
Well, this was a report in the Metro. It started off by saying that Amber Rudd was Home Secretary, but later on it called her the Minister of the Interior. This is just fascinating, as we'll see later. Theresa May is becoming the leader, and she's going to lead us into a new global world. The nation is to unite behind this leader. I think I've seen some of this language before. Mm. But before we get on to that, just have a look at the Mail report here, because this is remarkable. In a very long article, which you'll find very easily, it's all about the bomber Salman Abidi. And this is the Mail's headline: How did he slip the net? Manchester terrorist Salman Abidi's own mother and his classmates warned security services he was dangerous and supported suicide bombings. So once again, we have the multi-billion pound British intelligence services warned. That's what they asked people to do, to warn them when they believed that there were dangerous individuals in this country. So the man's own family warned the intelligence services and nothing happens. Well, in fact, it does. There's a bomb. Reports in the press today said that Amber Rudd says, well, they were warned to a point. So we are paying multi-billion pounds for GCHQ, MI6, MI5, Special Branch, SO13, and none of these people can identify a paedophile in Westminster, but they also can't identify a bomber, even when the man's own family said to them that he was dangerous. Now, could it be that they turned a blind eye in order to help Theresa May's election campaign? I don't think anybody could believe that, but we can ask the question, how is it that Britain's intelligence services can't stop this, even when they're told it's going to happen? It's remarkable, isn't it?
Absolutely. What's next?
Well, this is, I believe, this is what you found, Mike,
absolutely,
actually,
yes.
Which is the leader has been visiting.
The leader has been visiting one of the victims, and I'm not going to cover the content of this. I wanted to show the picture of the leader attending the victim, and I just thought the sort of body language between these two was quite interesting, because first of all, the patient is looking away almost with a look of, well, disdain, perhaps disparaging, anyway.
Well, we could say that the young lady would be in a fairly fragile state, so maybe she's looking into the distance.
But Theresa May is looking distinctly uncomfortable.
Uncomfortable. Why am I here? Don't know what to say. What do you think, David? I saw this photograph just very briefly before we came on air, and Theresa May just looks highly embarrassed, not quite sure why she's there, not quite sure what to say, weighed down by her beads.
Well, she's clearly under duress. So exactly what that duress is, but perhaps it's something to do with the way that she's effectively being controlled, instructed, directed and managed. And this is clearly the case within the Conservative Party, and we've got some quite clear precedents of that. Look what's just been revealed about Johnny Mercer. He wanted to be managed, can't speak about things. You know, we don't want you to talk about the veterans. You're going to have to shut up or we'll deselect you. This is exactly what happened to Maggie Thatcher when she said no on the second occasion to military union. She was exited the following week after saying no in Parliament. We can see the same again under Rupert Allenson. Interestingly, he had exactly the same thing when he went against the party line. So politicians that want to think and do their job, MPs that want to do their job and are sort of saying, you know, this is what we should and shouldn't be doing. If they don't toe the party line, they're out. There's another example, of course, and that's Enoch Powell. He was saying, no, that immigration was a bad idea from his point of view. And, of course, he was summarily exited again. Now, obviously, what we've got here, we now know with the benefit of hindsight that all of these bigger issues of military union and free movement of people or free movement of money are master EU policies.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we've got a legitimate question here, really, and that is, has Theresa May got Stockholm syndrome? Is she in love with her captors?
Right.
That's quite a question.
That's quite a question. Thank you for that one. Well, David, you picked up on what you said was happening on the post-Manchester bomb Twitter sphere. And we thought we'd pick up on some of this. The bomb itself, bad enough. But of course, all sorts of things now being stirred up. We've got some pretty questionable stuff here. This is from Alf Garnett. Careful what you say, chaps. We don't want to hurt their feelings and make them attack us any more than they're going to already. We've got this one down here. What have we got here? Oh, this is Katie Hopkins. Who will protect our kids from terror politicians let in? Now, that's a pretty interesting statement. There's quite a lot of criticism about this lady here and there. But could it be she's starting to get focused on some of the important questions? This one here, dear ISIS, Adolf Hitler couldn't himself couldn't even stop the English from getting milk with their cornflakes. So you've F all hope. Now, the real picture there is a man carrying milk through the London bomb.
The Blitz.
Thank you, Mike. Some wag underneath has said, well, actually, the picture was photoshopped. I'll leave you to think about that one. And this one here from retweeted from Roger Lane Knott. Fancy your chances against grown men, not children. Give us a call with the British Army. Now, it's interesting. There's a wide range of opinions coming forward, but people are desperately unsettled and they want to know what to do.
Yes. Well, perhaps MPs are a little bit unsettled as well. This is a report today from Demos. It's called Signal and Noise. Can technology provide a window into the world of digital policies in the UK? Of course, in its own way, it's an attack on social media and so on. But what they're saying is British society and its politics are increasingly influenced by social media, which presents both democratic opportunities and also practical challenges for MPs. If they're unable to make sense of the digital noise or feel overwhelmed by the sheer breadth of information or hostile interactions, their confidence to engage is threatened. Furthermore, social media creates measures of opinion organised by themes that can be difficult for MPs to understand or value, relative to more traditional measures of influence or representation. And yet the growth of digital politics also creates more expectations about what people expect of their elected representatives and what MPs might expect in return. So their conclusions are basically that a large amount of politics and political conversation is now taking place online, creating a new digital commons. The data created by this digital commons is too large for MPs to manage, and technological solutions are necessary. Does that mean censorship, I wonder? Technology is effective in handling the data that makes up this new digital commons. And their main concern here is that in the period between the 9th of May and the 18th of August last year, that MPs received around 188,000 abusive tweets, and that two-thirds of those tweets were coming from accounts registered to men. And they said that the abuse reached a peak on the day of the EU referendum result, and then a further peak when Boris Johnson pulled out of the race to become the leader of the Tory party. Again, this looks like another attack on social media, but basically what they seem to be saying, Brian, is that MPs are getting too hard questions, or there's a little bit of abuse coming their way. So they're going to have to use technology to filter all that stuff out, any criticism, any hard questions, just filter all that out so that these poor MPs with their tiny brains can manage the data that's left to them.
These are very delicate people, Mike. Of course, in the old days, going back even as far as I can remember, MPs had to be out on the streets. They had to be talking publicly. They had to be shouting over the top of hecklers who were there to do, in principle, quite a good job. They had to brave rotten eggs and a few other things thrown at them. But the MPs now are so delicate that if you question why they're not doing their job, you are vexatious, you're some sort of hate individual. And of course, my own Gary Streeter, Tory party representative, he came back with what was very personal abuse, really, when I simply asked for his comment on the front page we could say some of the better papers, but some of the mainstream papers, so the Times and the Telegraph, talking about the demise of our military, asking the question, comes back with a personal attack. So they're very fragile people. I wonder whether it's guilt. Well, let's have a look at how local media can deal with events. And we were very interested with this one. It's the Plymouth Herald. Police decision on whether to deploy military on Plymouth streets after Manchester attacks. Now, that little headline leads you to believe that the police are in the process of making a decision, and you think, there are more military coming on the streets. But when you read the article, that's absolutely not what the key message is. This man, James Vaughan, Deputy Chief Constable, is saying Operation Tempora will now be activated alongside other established and tested plans. meaning that military personnel may now be deployed onto the streets under police command and control. Locations for deployment are agreed at a national level, and at this stage, there are no plans for deployment in Devon, Cornwall and the Isles of Scilly. So, you know, this is, you can just say it's sloppy on one hand, but if you follow it along, the bombing, and now we've got fear, we've all to be fearful, we've got to have troops on the streets. We didn't need that for the IRA, but we do for Daesh, ISIS, Al-Qaeda, whatever it is. And then we've got people not being stoical, standing up and saying, we're going to carry on. We've got manipulation of press reports. And this is another one I think you've got coming up.
Well, but I would just say on this, you know, this is sheer hypocrisy on the part of the Herald, because the Herald, like all the other mainstream papers, jumped on the fake news bandwagon. And one of the signs of fake news that has been promoted since the beginning is the use of clickbaity headlines. And that, to me, is a clickbaity headline.
Yeah.
So hypocrisy, well, unbelievable hypocrisy.
We'll call it clickbait then.
Well, David, this one is really from you. It's a tweet that came out on US Defense Journal, from US Defense Journal this morning. And the tweet says, missile marked Love from Manchester reportedly sent into battle against Islamic State. This didn't make us feel terribly comfortable. What are your thoughts on this type of rhetoric?
Yeah, I mean, just going back to this and the other tweets, did a bit of a sift this morning, just a quick snapshot, just to see what the reaction was. So obviously the government will be doing this. They will be assessing the reaction on all the social media and processing all that data and information. So, you know, this will be being analysed. So we can't underestimate that. So we've got to come back to two fundamental things, really. There's a precedent in this country for this sort of thing, and we also have common law. So under common law, murder is is recognised there as being a crime. So let's just look at it in those very, very sort of stoic terms. This is a crime, okay, full stop. And justice is blind. It doesn't recognise. It doesn't recognise any of the other facets that are coming through into social media about religion and race and so on and so forth. Common law doesn't look at that. It just looks at the crime. End of. Now, we've got a terrific precedent in our history for this, and that is under Queen Elizabeth I, where she has stated that she did not want to make windows of men's souls during the troubles between that followed on from Henry VIII between Protestants and Catholics. So this is exactly the same. We should not be making religion an issue. We should focus on one thing and one thing alone, that murdering anyone is a crime. And that's it. Don't go down all these other avenues. Otherwise, you will lose sight of what the principal issue is. So that's the thing, really, that I'm concerned at, is we're seeing a lot of stuff on Twitter about escalating and violence and retribution and so on and so forth. No. That isn't going to suit anybody, because the state, if that happens, will come down even harder. And nobody wants that. So my advice and countenance is let's just stick to the issue. If anybody perpetrates these sorts of things in Britain, it is a crime. And that's it. And they should be held and taken to task and taken to trial under that basis. So that's really, really, I think, that what we ought to all come back to and just focus on that.
Yep, I agree with that. Calm down the rhetoric and start to think through what's actually happening here, what's taking place in the country, why it's taking place, and who's driving it.
Here's a little bit more of the rhetoric, because Colonel Richard Kemp was on BBC Radio Ulster's Nolan programme yesterday, and he was stating that, you know, according to MI5, there are 3,000 people in Britain suspected of being involved in terrorist activity. He said that... That's obviously far too many people for our security services to hope to put surveillance on and to prevent them from carrying out attacks. He said, what I'm talking about is those people who are not British citizens, who the intelligence services have strong intelligence to show that they're involved in terrorism. They should be subjected to a process overseen by politicians and the courts, which enables them then to be deported from this country so they no longer pose a threat to us. He went on to say, I would rather see people deported than I would like to see more British teenagers killed on our streets because we're not prepared to protect them in that way, and so on. He then went on to say that there is an option for British citizens who are strongly suspected by the intelligence services of being involved in terrorism, but who cannot be put in front of a court because they don't have sufficient evidence to put before a court. And that is internment, which we had in Northern Ireland. The intelligence services would have to produce evidence, the state would have to endorse it, and judges would have to approve the message, the measures. Of course, it's got to be proportionate to the threat that we face, and it has to be carefully controlled. I'm not suggesting that we become a police state or that we act outside the law. What I am suggesting is that our politicians take responsibility for protecting the people in this country in a situation that is rapidly spiralling out of control, and look at this event in Manchester as one of a series of very, very serious terrorist attacks that have taken place in Europe in the last couple of years. They are increasing, and something must be done to stop it. Now, I have a whole list of issues with what he has said here, but let's try to go through one or two of these. First of all, he said that British citizens who are suspected of by the intelligence services of being involved in terrorism, but who we can't put in front of a court because we don't have sufficient evidence to put them before a court, we should inter. But then he goes on to say that intelligence services would have to produce evidence and the state would have to endorse it and judges would have to approve it. So clearly what he's calling for is a lower standard of evidence. But this, you know, this simply did not work in Ireland. It isn't going to work in this case either. David, it seems to me that the United States is busy trying to get rid of its internment program in Guantanamo Bay at the moment. So do you see any rational argument for this?
Well, the argument has to come back to a sort of a base level here. And it needs to be, you know, this particular perpetrator here in Manchester is exactly the same as it, what's happened there is exactly the same as Dunblane. That the parents have, according to these reports, have made reports that, you know, they suspected he was dangerous. And, you know, has he been picked up? No, he's been allowed to carry on. And this dreadful event has taken, you know, this dreadful massacre of people has taken place. So it's exactly the same as Dunblane. This happened there. And upon inquiry and review, the police officers on the beat, on the coalface there, have said that this man must have his guns taken away from him, you know, and they were ignored and overridden. So what on earth is going on here with MI5 and MI6 and the security services? I don't know. Whether it's because they're overloaded, underfunded, you know, they cannot just process the amount of reports and flags that they're getting accurately or safely. I mean, clearly that's the case because they've missed this guy. You know, their sort of sift rates are apparently 2-3% of those that are flagged. So out of 100 flags that get sent in that we need to look at this person, you know, only 2-3 actually get picked up and followed through. So how they're going through that process, you know, I don't know. I couldn't comment on that. But that seems to be the sort of the stuff that's coming out. So it's clearly not right. It's not working. And we have to come back again to Theresa May while she was Home Secretary, who's responsible for all of this. As is Amber Rudd now, you know, and these people are seeking re-election. No, absolutely no. It cannot be allowed. It cannot be allowed.
Brian, is it the wrong approach perhaps to stop this happening in the first place? I mean, where are these guys coming from? They're coming from action that we've taken in the Middle East, whether it be Libya, well, Syria, Iraq, wherever it is. They're coming from organisations that we've been funding.
Yeah. You're absolutely correct. And I remember quite a few years ago giving a talk in the Midlands to, I think it was a BNP meeting. It was an extremely interesting meeting. I was invited to talk about common purpose, and that was the primary subject of my talk. At one stage, well, towards the end, when I was asked questions, somebody said to me, that they were very concerned about levels of immigration, and they were concerned about the mosques, and they were concerned about the Muslims. And I asked a simple question, and that was, how did these people get into the country? And initially, there was almost silence to that question. So I had to prompt. I said, did these people fight their way ashore? And eventually, somebody from the back of the room shouted, no, we let them in. And I said, with a little bit of humour, you let them in. I always wanted to know who let them in. And then there was a fairly blunt response. But eventually somebody said, well, the politicians let these people in. And that is the truth of the matter. So if we start to look at what has been going on here, we've got displaced people, as Patrick Henningsen has said, many of them absolutely fleeing from war and violence. They are invited into the country by our own politicians. So the people we need to focus on, first of all, are the people who opened the gates. The people who were invited in, that's a secondary problem, because what we're looking at is those individuals who've come in alongside them. But again, the politicians are responsible. And I have to say that by the end of the meeting, I had a lot of people beginning to discuss the reality that the problem has been caused, fermented, driven by our own politicians. And if we go back 30 years, those politicians overwhelmingly white and would call themselves Christians. So, David, you might like to counter with me here, but I found it fascinating to be with that group of people and to ask a simple question, how did all these people get into our country? And then you've got to prompt them. It was the fact that our own government has created this problem for us.
What we've got to do is just think very clearly. We've got to assess what's going on clearly and really take a leaf out of Marcus Aurelius's book. You know, just what is the nature of what we're dealing with? What is the nature of the thing? What is the nature of the problem? And the nature of the problem is that we have dreadfully low acumen in our political interface. That is the problem. So we've got to get our finger out and start electing people that have got a higher level of acumen and respect for the people in their provinces that they purport to represent. And this is the principal problem as to what, going back to what I said earlier about Maggie being pushed out when she said no to military union, and Rupert Allenson when he said no to Maastricht, and Enoch Powell when he said no, we shouldn't be taking down this road of immigration. And Johnny Mercer, no, you know, we don't want you talking about veterans. What we've got to have is either enough criticality within any particular party to actually be the government and actually represent the people so that we can all get on and live in peace and build bridges and get on with each other. Or if we carry on like we are, all that we're going to have is more of the same, because it isn't going to change under the current regime. And this is the principal problem, is that what we're seeing really is that this facade that we see in number 10 under May or Cameron or whatever, they're not actually the government. They're just the bit at the front. The government is actually behind, and we can't see who they are. Nor can we get at them, and nor can we have an impact upon policy. And this is the biggest problem, is that these politicians, you know, let's do a vox pop amongst the current Tory group that are seeking re-election. How many of them, other than Ben Gummer, who apparently has written the manifesto, how many of them have actually written some policy that's been evaluated and approved by their associations that they represent in their regions? You know, let's get to the nub of this, because we just seem to be having policy spoon-fed from somewhere else remotely. And this is the problem.
Right. Totally agree with that, David. And when you come to the hidden hand, the shadow government, who's putting the pressure on, we must come to the people who are controlling the purse strings. So very appropriate time to bring in our advert on the back of this letter from the Rothschild banking empire advising the Chancellor on steps he should take to reform and correct what is happening in the banking industry. So poacher turned gamekeeper, but we're saying that tonight in the Lugger at 7:30, that's the Lugger pub in Penzance, there's a talk on the lie of austerity and the national debt. So if you're local in the southwest, perhaps you come along and attend, give support to the team. Now, I'm just going to return to how things are being put together. We showed this yesterday. We're going to bring it up on screen because if people have not seen this document, they need to. This is what Theresa May has got ready to go in the background, the Armed Forces Deployment Royal Prerogative Bill. And my goodness, as Mike said, this is absolutely an enabling act. The provisions required for deployment of Her Majesty's Armed Forces by the Prime Minister in the event of a conflict overseas. And we pointed out that actually, whilst it says overseas, that when you get into the body of the text, what you start to see is this is talking about emergency and security situations. So we've highlighted it there. Approval is not required for a conflict decision if the emergency condition or security condition in this section is met. So this is a very ambiguous document. It says that it's Her Majesty's Armed Forces, but actually this is the key bit, which is so terrifying, because it is for the Prime Minister to determine if the emergency conditions or the security conditions is met. The Prime Minister should, if feasible, it may be too difficult and therefore don't bother, that's what that's saying. If the Prime Minister determines, the Prime Minister, this is the Führer, Mike, this is the leader.
Yes, it's not just an enabling act, it's a coup.
It's a coup, absolutely. This is a coup. David, I can see that you're keen to come back in here. This is a truly dangerous, dangerous document. If the Lib Dems and Labour do not understand what's coming here, they are about to see their parties simply shut into the wilderness with an enabling act.
Yeah, everybody really needs to see that this is the nub of everything. This is such an important thing that's happening here, and everybody needs to pay attention. Everybody needs to propagate this on their social media. This is vital. Is this Prime Minister seeking absolute power or power in absolute? That is what this Enabling Act is actually looking like. So I'm sort of saying, you know, really, it wants to be every single Crown officer or officer of the Crown or warrant officer needs to pay attention to this, because this is looking like power in absolute in the hands of one person, the Prime Minister. And that is not how it works in this country.
David, we have had civil wars in the past over the issue of the divine right of kings. We've been arguing over the last few years that we've been seeing an increasing a parliament with an increasing view of itself that they have the divine right to do anything. But here again, we see this now concentrated into one person.
That's quite right. This is looking like divine power in the hands of the Prime Minister to enable. You know, I mean, what we're seeing really is the merging of Her Majesty's Armed Forces, the Crown Armed Forces, merging with the police into what effectively looks like a police state. You know, this must be stopped, and it must be stopped very quickly. There needs to be a substantial outcry from all of those in office.
Yeah. Well, we're drilling a little bit deeper because if we go back to 2015, UK Column was warning about this particular one. If we can pop this one on screen.
Oh, sorry, wrong. Yeah.
Here we go. We've got police carrying guns on routine call-outs, including tens of thousands of minor incidents of burglaries or even car crashes. But the meat of it was that the private company, ACPO, a private company, albeit the Association of Chief Police Officers, has now created a 6,000-strong, fully armed private army. And we said at the time, when was this sinister policy debated in Parliament? And of course, it never was. So a private limited company, ACPO, simply made a decision to arm its police officers. And now we've got those police in charge of the army on the streets. This is unbelievably dangerous. OK, ACPO has now changed its spots to the Police Chiefs Council or something like that, but it still applies. So who is behind the police? Well, of course, we've got G4S, we've got Serco, we've got IBM and behind them are the bankers. We have got a private army being created here. This is very dangerous. And if we stay in 2015, it was Russia Today that was warning what was coming in the UK were secret courts. This was part of the cartoons there. I find you guilty of domestic extremism. Do you have anything to say for yourself? It's no good me telling him again I'm innocent. He's made up his mind. So we've got Theresa May's next step is criticiser, and you're a domestic terrorist. Does this mean that anybody that does what the UK column is doing today, which is challenging the government over their policies and their security, their anti-terrorism policies, is simply going to be put in a private court with a single judge and declared guilty of being a domestic terrorist?
Yes, or the extremist? Central answer to that.
Okay, and what do you use to help this along? Well, you blur what is war and what is peace. And we showed this a few days ago from the Joint Warfare Directorate. The challenge, the distinction between war and peace and home and away are increasingly blurred. Think of that statement, the distinction between war and peace and home and away are increasingly blurred. Now think of that document we've just seen, which starts out talking about the deployment of troops during war, and in fact is really meaning the exact opposite. And I'll do a couple more of these just to ram this home. Here we are in the year 2000, and Tony Blair, the Prime Minister, has a vision of a new Britain. Central to this vision is the creation of a new class, a new elite, placed in positions of authority, who will propagate the new spirit of the age and spread the principles of the third way across Britain. Very quickly, David, the evidence is all in front of our eyes here. It's just in front of us when we look properly.
Correct. Absolutely correct, Brian. Everybody just needs to wake up. It's clearly in front of you all. It may be that your reality is going to be challenged, and you're just going to have to sort of pull yourself up by your bootstraps and push on through. The most important thing is that you don't stall and then do nothing.
Yep.
So you keep saying action conquers fear. People have got to go through this. They've got to work through this, and they've all got to work together. And we've all got to close ranks. Otherwise, it will be a police state very, very quickly.
Right. Now, look at these two statements against everything we've covered so far. This is going back to December 2010. Nicholas Bowles, MP, quoted in The Guardian, the Prime Minister and his deputy, Nick Clegg, want their people power revolution to unleash chaotic effects across local communities. Chaotic, therefore, in our vocabulary, is a good thing. And if that's not enough, let's bring in Mr. Kruger here. He says the Conservatives' plan to introduce a period of, quote, creative destruction in the public services. These are immensely dangerous people, and they know absolutely what they're doing. This is effectively the seeds of bloody revolution in order to get their new agenda into place. And if you want to see the real meat of it, have a look at this document. Here's the Tory manifesto. In the conclusion, I just couldn't believe this. If we have the strong and stable leadership our national interest demands, leader, yeah. Theresa May and her team, not a government, the leader and her team. So this is Conservative coup, hashtag Conservative coup. This is right in front of our eyes.
And just to tie this together with what David has been talking about for the last couple of years, we'll come back to this issue of the merging of police, civilian and military command and control, Brian, and remind us that this originally, the first time I heard of this idea was a combination of NATO and the European Defence Agency. And it began with a speech by Federica Mogherini in November 2015. Where she absolutely called for civilian and military command and control structures to be merged, and some corporate interests in that as well. Yeah. And of course, if we look at what's going on with the privatization of police, David, just in 2 minutes, we're going to end up with the police apparently in charge of military, and what, the police sold to G4S, so our military in the hands of G4S?
Yeah, I've got local policemen actually saying this openly. You know, all middle low and ranking police officers on the coalface are actually saying this. They're actually saying it openly. So we're seeing the blending and the corporatization of it. And it's dreadful. It is absolutely dreadful. Now, where the military are concerned, I really do want to say this. I remember back, Brian and I, when we were in Parliament Square with the Al Blackman and Royal Marine parade to try and get the politicians to let Al Blackman go, the political prisoner. And Jonathan Goldberg, the QC, said at the time that under the circumstances, and what effectively I understand what he meant by that was that the servicemen are in a state of no man's land legally. And I'm reassured by that by a couple of very, very, very senior lawyers who have had the same conversation with me on what's going on with the law and the MOD currently. And we can see that manifested by the pursuit of servicemen from going back now to Northern Ireland and the Troubles and Iraq and so on and so forth, and Al obviously in Afghanistan. What Jonathan Goldberg said in Parliament Square was that if any serviceman discharges their weapon currently at a non-uniformed terrorist or insurgent, they will find themselves liable for murder charges. Now, this guy's a QC, and he said that in Parliament Square. So all of you, take heed.
OK, well, look, we're pretty much out of time, Brian, but I just want to briefly mention the NATO heads of government meeting today. We'll go into this in more detail tomorrow on tomorrow's programme. But, David, I just wanted to mention one aspect of this, because aside from their claims that they're going to formally join the coalition against ISIS and their demands for more money from various member states, one of the things that is of note is that NATO has just opened, or is in the process of opening, its new headquarters, which, strangely enough, are based in Brussels. As part of the programme for this afternoon, there's going to be a walkthrough of the new NATO headquarters for all the attendees. So Jens Stoltenberg said this will be an historic milestone, a new home for a modern alliance. But what interested me was that they, in this process, are, as they describe it, marking the handover of its new headquarters from Belgium to NATO. So what we seem to have here is, this seems to be a bit similar, I suppose, which has just gone completely out of my head.
I'm afraid I can't help you immediately.
Ambassador, an embassy, right?
An embassy.
Thank you.
Yeah, okay.
An embassy, where, of course, if you have an embassy in a nation state, that embassy is considered to be the territory of the country whose embassy it is. So NATO seems to be in the same position. But NATO, as far as I'm aware, is not a sovereign nation. So if they're handing the headquarters from Belgium to NATO, this becomes NATO's territory. What is the legal status of this organisation?
It's very interesting indeed. And we're obviously going to have to spend more time on that one.
Yes, David, quickly.
Yeah, I mean, this is supranational stuff right in everyone's faces. As I've said and warned continually, NATO is but a bus, and it's rounded all of these national militaries up on a bus, and that bus is going to arrive at Brussels, and it's just done that, and it's going to drop everyone off in Brussels. Now, I had a conversation with a very senior Conservative the other day, who telephoned and wanted to know about EU military union and EU military unification. And what we discussed was that bilateral defence agreements, fine. Everybody doesn't seem to have a problem with that. But what actually is going on is that multiple bilateral defence agreements are actually EU military unification. And people, the MPs are not seeing this. They don't see what's actually happening, is that the whole situation is being literally amalgamated. All of these national militaries are being amalgamated into EU military union via this military unification process. And that these bilateral agreements, whether that be with NATO or whether that be under the Franco-British Council arrangement or whether it's under Mike Fallon's enhanced defence union with Germany, actually equate to EU military unification, and it will lead to EU military union. So there's no guesswork involved here, everybody, that the NATO headquarters is in Brussels. It's telling you now what is going to happen to our military if it isn't stopped and debated now. And if there's one thing Brian and I have found, is that these Tory MPs are under instruction not to debate this. And it's vital now. If Labour want to win some votes or UKIP want to win some votes, get out there now and challenge these people and make this an issue. Because if we don't, we'll lose our military to the EU. And there'll be no Brexit.
Okay. Well said. Excellent.
Right. We'll just end on this one, because if anything sums up the mindset of people at the moment, this is a maths paper, primary school maths paper, it seems, for somebody. So I've hidden the answers, which were handwritten in the bottom right hand corner of this, because I don't want this to be the pupil involved to be identified at all. But this is a maths paper. And what does it say there? Defuse the bomb, solving equations. It has a picture of a rectangle which represents a bomb with some coloured wires coming out of it. The coloured wires represent numbers, and they have to solve the equations to defuse the bomb. What is it that we're doing to our children here?
Well, we are reframing them, Mike. This is going on an unprecedented scale. And of course, majority of people still totally unaware of the government's behavioural insights team, which is a propaganda machine to reframe the way people think, and particularly children.
Yep.
That's it and all about it. David, thank you very much for joining us. Thank you very much for joining us. Just to say, a couple of people criticised me because I pointed a finger at the police with their weapons on the streets and described them as scruffy in their baseball caps. I stand by that description. I think it is a piece of uniform designed to cheapen our police, and I am disappointed that any police officer would want to be seen in a, quote, McDonald's baseball cap. And I'll also say that we're interested in our comments around Tommy Robinson and rhetoric following the bombing seems to have hit the right spot, because we've had people accusing us of being pro-Tommy Robinson and people accusing us of attacking him, people saying we're pro-Islam and people saying, well, of course not. What we are here to do is to get people to look at the real facts and information and start to think. Because if we don't do this, we're going to simply fall for the propaganda coming out of the government. And UK Column is not going to back down on the important issues, even if people start to feel uncomfortable. That's it. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back tomorrow. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.